Without any further housekeeping issues, I'd like to introduce our first speaker today. It's Dr. Robert Fitzgibbons. He is the Harry Suckerhoff Professor of Surgery at Creighton University. He did his medical school training at Creighton. He left there to do his general surgery training at Louisiana State University, followed by a fellowship in biliary pancreatic surgery at Lahey Clinic in Boston. He then returned to Creighton, where he has continued to make his name in the areas of biliary and pancreatic surgery, but also in the area of hernia surgery, where he has been the principal investigator of two major grants, multi-million dollar grants, one on the management of groin hernia, a multi-centered clinical trial that looked at comparing watchful waiting to routine hernia repair, and also the VA cooperative study looking at tension-free inguinal hernia repair, open versus laparoscopic, that really has been cited quite a few times around the world. He's the past president of the American Hernia Society. He has over 300 scholarly publications, and he's the editor-in-chief of the journal Hernia. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker today, Dr. Robert Fitzgibbons, who will be talking to us today on complications of inguinal herniorrhaphy, from post-inguinal herniorrhaphy pain to infertility. Dr. Fitzgibbons, please welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Johnson, for that very nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be back in Phoenix again. I've had the privilege of being on the podium here several times now, and it's always great to get back. So this is my faculty disclosures. There's nothing that would conflict with what we're going to talk about today. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say here is based on randomized controlled trials, and I've had a strong interest in my career in randomized controlled trials. But I start off the lecture with a caveat, and that is that not all randomized controlled trials are perfect when you're evaluating hernia problems. And this is an article by Klinge from Aachen in Germany, who is a well-known investigator in this area of abdominal wall reconstruction. And he has some very important co-authors, Dr. Ben David from the Schulteis Clinic, and Dr. Enrico from the American Hernia Society. And they, in this paper, they point out about 12 different items that are important in randomized controlled trials that are basically violated by most of the trials that we do. And it has to do with the heterogeneity of hernias and how they present in different ways. So randomized controlled trials are particularly difficult in this subject, and I encourage anybody to read that article if they have the time, and it wouldn't get too bored because it's pretty statistical. But it's in the handout if you want to look at it. Well, let's start off with just some basic definitions. Now, you might say, am I talking to a group of junior medical students or experienced surgeons like are in this audience today? Why do I have to define an inguinal hernia? Well, the reason why I do that is because in the literature, inguinal hernias are sometimes grouped with femorals. So sometimes when you're reading the literature, when somebody is talking about an inguinal hernia, they mean direct, indirect, and femoral. But for the purposes of this presentation, an inguinal hernia is only in direct and indirect, and a femoral hernia is separate. Now, the lifetime risk of an inguinal hernia in males is about 27%. And in females is about 3%. That's a sort of a consensus from the literature because the numbers are all over the place, like so many things in hernia surgery. For example, this is a study from Olmsted County. I put it in there because of my respect for Clive Grant, who's here in the audience today. one of his partners, Dr. Farley, did this study, and he showed that in Olmsted County, where the Mayo Clinic resides in Rochester, 42.5% of men were going to have a hernia repair, not just a hernia, but would have a hernia repair in their lifetimes, and 5.8% in women. And it just points out that there's a huge discrepancy in reporting of incidence of hernia. Now, we know that the right-sided hernias are more common than the left, and that hernias are 10 times more common in males than females. This slide is to point out the importance of incarceration, because in the literature, oftentimes incarceration and strangulation are written about as if they are synonymous. But of course, they aren't synonymous. Many incarcerated hernias are chronic, and they don't have any symptoms at all. The patient may have no symptoms. So we have to separate strangulated from incarcerated hernias. Now, what about the incidence of hernia repairs, or incidence of an inguinal hernia, say, at a given age? Well, that data is very difficult to obtain, especially in the United States, where you just simply cannot get whole groups of populations or representative stratified set of patients that you could examine and see if they had hernias. But as pointed out yesterday, we looked to the Scandinavia for many of these population-based type things, but even there, they can't examine asymptomatic patients and try to get at the incidence of an inguinal hernia. But this paper is important by Nielsen and his group from Sweden, because it demonstrated how operation inguinal hernia repair can be used as a surrogate for the incidence of an inguinal hernia at any given age. In this particular paper, they were talking about recurrence rate, and they determined that if you multiplied the number of patients undergoing surgery for a recurrent hernia by 100% plus 40, in other words, 140%, you could arrive at an accurate incidence figure. Now, this is another Scandinavian study looking at the incidence of hernias, again based on inguinal hernia repair as a surrogate, and you can see there's a bimodal peak of inguinal hernias at infancy, and then again in the ages in 70 to 75, where we have spikes in the incidence of hernia of groin hernia. But basically, the incidence of hernia rises steadily throughout life, from about the teenage years to about 70, where it begins to fall off. Not as dramatic in females, but still it does rise as it does in males. Now, groin hernias in women. Femoral hernias are more common in women than men. A woman with a groin mass is still 5 times more likely to have an inguinal hernia than a femoral hernia. So still, hernias are more common in the inguinal region. Inguinal hernias in women are almost always indirect, and 35 to 40% of femoral hernias present with strangulation. Why do we develop hernias? Well, this slide is, I'm sure all of you have seen, when we went from the quadruped to the biped stance, we left our groins unprotected. That probably has something to do with it. Debatable, though. But these factors that I list here are very commonly considered by most authorities to be problematic for developing hernias. Male sex, family history, certainly COPD and smoking, high interabdominal pressure for a variety of reasons, collagen vascular disease, aneurysmal disease, both thoracic and abdominal, a patent processus vaginalis, we all know is predisposing, and then more recently, biochemical abnormalities such as matrix metamyoproteinosis abnormalities. Heavy lifting, what is the role of heavy lifting in the development of an inguinal hernia? We have occasional lifting, repeated lifting, single strenuous event, these are all debatable area. Recent systemic review is inconclusive as to whether this actually causes inguinal hernias, despite the common accepted in the lay public. And also, we know that weightlifters do not have an excessive rate of inguinal hernias. So the role of strenuous activity or heavy lifting has really come into question in recent years. Now, critical anatomy. In order for me to discuss complications, we must make sure we're on the same page with our anatomy. What are the critical structures? We have the inferior epigastric vessels, the iliac vessels, internal sphermatic, vas deferens, the inguinal ligament down here. Then you've got the direct and indirect spaces, of course. The transversus abdominis muscle is very important, as we'll see in a minute. Rectus abdominis, iliopsoas, and the superior ramus of the pubis with attached Cooper's ligament. These are the critical anatomical landmarks that are important to all of us as hernia surgeons. And this, by understanding these anatomical landmarks, we can define the borders of the myopectineal orifice of Fischard, which is so important in the etiology of inguinal hernias. It's bordered by the termination of the aponeurotic fibers of the transversus abdominis muscle, the rectus muscle, the iliopsoas muscle, and then a Cooper's ligament inferiorly. Why is that myopectineal orifice so important? It's because basically the root cause of all inguinal hernia, all groin hernias, is failure of the peritoneum and the transverse fascia to protect us in the myoperitoneal area. So if we can, hernia repairs that are based on reinforcing the myopectineal orifice can result in resolution of the problem. And that's the basis of the laparoscopic operations. Here we see an inguinal hernia with the second slide showing the peritoneum and the transverse fascia reflected downward. And of course, we put a mesh and between those two structures, and that covers the entire myopectineal orifice, and that's the end of the hernia. Now, the anterior anatomy, we were all taught in medical school that it is a very complicated anatomy and very difficult to understand. But actually, now with the widespread use of the tension-free Lichtenstein approach or one of its modifications, the anatomy really, in my mind, has become very simple. It's just simply a box. You've got a box. The top of that box is the external oblique aponeurosis. The bottom of that box is the internal oblique muscle. Now, when you open that box by opening the external oblique through the external ring, you create a little two flaps, and the caudal end of that flap is the inguinal ligament, and the cranial end of that is the junction of the external oblique and the internal oblique after you've dissected the internal oblique or the external oblique off of the internal oblique. So it's pretty simple anatomy now, as far as I'm concerned. So with that background, let me get on to what I'm supposed to be talking about here, and that is complications. So how do we treat a groin hernia? Well, you have the open anterior approach, which can either be sutured or prosthetic, and you have the preperitoneal approach, or so-called posterior approach, which can either be through a groin incision or laparoscopic. And these complications I'm going to talk about will touch on all of these different approaches. So I like to break down inguinal hernia complications into this group: recurrence, chronic groin pain, wound complications, cord and testicular, bowel and bladder, prosthetic, general, and laparoscopic. So we'll talk about them one at a time. I may not get to the last few because of time, but we'll get as far as we can go. Recurrence. Let's start off with discussing recurrence, because that is a very important patient-centered outcome, obviously. When they come to the doctor, they want to have their hernia repaired properly and not have it come back. So recurrence is very important. Well, let's start off with tension-free versus sutured. Well, the question of whether a tension-free repair is better than a sutured repair has been settled. Everybody would agree that the tension-free has a lower recurrence rate. This is a meta-analysis which is often quoted from the European Hernia Trialist Group, in which they performed a meta-analysis. They pointed out that population-based studies demonstrated about a 10 to 15% recurrence rate with sutured repairs, and with the widespread adoption of routine prosthesis in hernia repair, the recurrence rate dropped 50 to 75%. Now, tension-free versus laparoscopic, is there an advantage to one operation over the other? An often referenced Cochrane analysis, which included 41 randomized trials, did not demonstrate any difference between open mesh and laparoscopic repairs. But that was an older study, and more recent data, a large cohort study from England showed that the laparoscopic repair has a little higher recurrence rate, 4.1 versus 2.1%. And then a more recent meta-analysis suggested a slightly higher recurrence rate with laparoscopy, too. No difference for recurrent hernias in any of these studies. This is a effectiveness paper from the Agency for Health-Related Quality of Life, and they looked at 30 trials looking at recurrence, and they noted that laparoscopic surgery was more likely to result in a recurrence, 4.46% versus 2.49%. But even though this might be statistically significant, the authors felt that perhaps this is not really clinically very relevant since the number is so small. Now, as far as recurrence for laparoscopic hernia is concerned, numerous studies have shown that the experience of the surgeon is by far the most important denominator in resulting in that. Inexperienced surgeons have poor results with higher complication and recurrence rates, and the learning curve is steep, and we don't really know exactly how many cases you need to do to become proficient. It may be more a matter of the quality of the training you're getting rather than the number of cases. In other words, if you're taught to do the wrong thing, you can do it 1,000 times and you're still going to be doing it wrong. Now, patient-related risk factors for a recurrence, again, these are vary quite a bit in the literature, but these four things are considered pretty consistent. Female sex, females have a higher recurrence rate than men, and we'll talk about why in a little bit. Direct inguinal hernias at the primary procedure, direct hernias have higher recurrence than indirects. A recurrent hernia, hernia that you're operating on to start off with recurrent, has a higher, and then smoking and COPD. These are very consistent patient-related risk factors. This is a study from Denmark demonstrating that in 85,000 patients, that the direct hernia recurrence rate is indeed higher than the indirect recurrence. Now, perhaps one of the most important aspects of hernia recurrence is the fact that the operation now is taken more seriously than it was in the past. It used to be that the first-year resident did most of the hernias taught by the second-year resident. Now that the operation is thought to be more important, recurrence rates have dropped. And this is just an example. This is a study published in the European Journal of Surgery in which they looked at 144 patients with 147 inguinal hernias in 1990 and compared that to a group in 1996. And the key point here is that in 1993, the surgical unit there decided to change inguinal hernia to a quotation marks high status and quotation marks operation. So what that meant was it was going to become an important teaching operation, and therefore the faculty was going to be heavily involved. They switched to Schulteis-Lichtenstein and laparoscopy, and it became a primary teaching operation, and the recurrence rate dropped from 28 to 3%. So taking the operation seriously is certainly very important. Okay, this is the only off-color slide I have in this thing, so I'll apologize for being politically incorrect, but it's important because groin hernia in women is a different disease, and we have to appreciate that as surgeons. There's a paucity of information in the literature to guide management of women with groin hernias. Of particular concern is their higher frequency of femoral hernias with attendant risk of strangulation. The most common operation in men, the Lichtenstein operation, will miss a femoral hernia unless it's specifically modified. Now, this was proven in this study from Sweden. Again, we depend upon Scandinavia so much for these population-based studies, but this is a study of 6,000 women from Sweden. There was a much higher femoral recurrence rate compared to men, especially after the repair of a direct hernia. But remember, direct hernias are almost reportable in females. They don't occur. So this provided very strong evidence that the femoral hernias were actually missed at the index operation. So if we're going to use a Lichtenstein tension-free approach, we've either got to modify the Lichtenstein or do what we call in my unit the Fitzenstein. So remember, when we repair an inguinal hernia using the Lichtenstein technique, the lower border is the inguinal ligament, as we see on this slide here. But if you don't modify this, then you're not going to address a femoral hernia because you're going to be above it. So what the Lichtenstein group does is to suture the inferior edge of the prosthesis to the inguinal ligament, just as is done with in a man. But then the bottom of the mesh is sutured to Cooper's ligament, and that does address the femoral canal. Now, I've never understood why they did that, why they do it that way. Why wouldn't they just sew the inferior edge of the prosthesis to Cooper's ligament in the first place and not worry about the inguinal ligament except after you get past the femoral vessels? And that's what we call the Fitzenstein operation. My residents call it that, at least. And, of course, laparoscopy addresses all three hernias in the myopectineal orifice of Richard, so many surgeons recommend laparoscopy routinely for females because of this fact. But you can also use a modified Lichtenstein. Okay, let's go on to chronic groin pain. I mentioned that probably the most important patient-centered outcome is recurrence for patients, but perhaps for surgeons, this problem of chronic groin pain is a bigger problem. And that's because this is the typical patient that we see. They come into your office, usually pointing one finger at an area that's very painful, very difficult to treat, and can be very incapacitating in some patients. The scope of the problem, the incidence, varies greatly in the literature. It seems to be decreased in specialty centers and increased in general practice, but that probably is debatable because it's the specialist centers that are publishing the data. It ranges from 0 to 53%, but the consensus is that it occurs in about 10% of patients, and in 2 to 4%, it is severe enough to interfere with daily living activities. Now, which operation is better is in regards to post-herniorrhaphy groin pain? This is a debated issue. In the European guidelines on chronic pain, the conclusion was that there is less pain after laparoscopic repair. Certainly, there's less pain with a tension-free repair than a sutured repair. In the effectiveness piece by the Agency for Health-Related Quality of Life, they did a meta-analysis of numerous studies, and they concluded that long-term pain after laparoscopic surgery is less than open surgery. This is another meta-analysis of surgical morbidity and recurrence after laparoscopic and open surgery, and in this paper, 14 trials were reviewed. And these are trials that actually included chronic groin pain in their analysis. Follow-up was 1 to 70 months. There were 1,975 patients in the laparoscopic group and 2,234 in the open. And the results showed significantly decreased risk for chronic groin pain in the laparoscopic group. But it was mainly in the TAP patients. TAP patients, there was no significant difference between chronic pain and an open. So, clearly both operations, both open tension-free procedures and laparoscopic operations result in chronic groin pain. It may be a little bit less for laparoscopy, but it's probably not dramatic. So what's the etiology? Well, we have nociceptive and neuropathic, and nociceptive is usually broken down into two different types, somatic and visceral. Somatic pain, that refers to bone and ligament type pain, osteitis pubis, ligament damage, muscle damage, that kind of thing. And it's probably the most common type of post-herniorrhaphy etiology. This is just an example of abductor tenosynovitis that you can get after a hernia repair that can result in this chronic groin pain. Visceral pain is also nociceptive, and this refers to pain during specific functional activities such as urination and ejaculation. And then, of course, neuropathic, and that refers to damage to a major nerve, a major sensory nerve, and that can be from a division, either partial or complete, stretching, contusion, cautering, crushing, suturing. Any of these etiologies can result in this problem. Treatment? ice, NSAIDs, and rest for the vast majority. Most will resolve spontaneously by 6 months, so certainly we don't want to do anything other than reassure the patient and treat them conservatively. If that doesn't work, though, in our shop, we have a five-step program. We go on to imaging studies to try to find either an occult recurrence or an occult other pathology. Our third step is physical therapy, and sometimes with specific stretching exercises, we can get some relief for these patients. Pain clinic is the next step, with injections and medical manipulations such as TENS units. Rarely works, but it's certainly worth a try, because the last step is surgery. I never do it before 1 year because it's very extensive. Our approach is a combined laparoscopic and conventional procedure. We do a triple neurectomy, remove all hardware, all mesh, do an adhesiolysis, because we don't want to go back in this groin again. So we want to make sure we do everything we can to try to stop this pain. And our results are variable, just like everybody. Maybe we see improvement in 75 to 80, but only partial in many of those. 20%, they probably don't see any value at all. Just some other adjuvant treatment strategies that don't work too well. Lidocaine patch has looked at in a randomized controlled trial, as you can see here. And the result was that it did not make any difference in a placebo-controlled trial. Ultrasound-guided iliohapic nerve blocks for persistent pain. Again, another double-blinded randomized trial. Ultrasound-guided lidocaine blocks did not do any good. They could not see the difference between the placebo group. Preservation versus division of inguinal nerves at the time of the index operation. Again, no significant difference in randomized control trials. So let's leave chronic groin pain and go on to wound complications. Fortunately, the infection rate in inguinal hernia surgery is very low. For some reason, the groin is a protected area, which is counterintuitive. Seromas, they can occur commonly with large indirect sacs in open surgery. More common with laparoscopic surgery because you leave a big dead space. Most will resolve spontaneously, and the best treatment is probably to leave it alone, because repeated aspiration results in an increased infection rate. But sometimes they're so tense and so painful that you have no choice. But if they're not, they're best left alone. Hematoma, less a problem with laparoscopic hernia. And again, best left alone to resolve on their own unless they are very symptomatic because of pressure. Cord and testicular problems. Okay, we got the swollen testicle after hernia surgery. What is it? Is it a hematoma? Is it a seroma? Is it orchitis? What do we know about ischemic orchitis? Well, it usually comes on 1 to 3 days following hernia surgery. Patient has a painful, indurated, swollen testicle, may have or may not have fever. It occurs in less than 1% of first-time hernia repairs, but can occur up to 5% of the time in operations for recurrent hernia. It's felt to be caused by injury to the pampiniform venous plexus rather than the testicular artery. Many people assume it's probably an arterial problem, but it probably is not. It probably is a venous problem. That was something that was preached by George Wants from New York. Testicular ultrasound is commonly used in diagnosing this problem. It almost always shows decreased blood flow, sometimes showing no blood flow. The treatment is non-operative with reassurance and analgesia, plus or minus antibiotics. Emergent orchiectomy is almost never indicated, but the problem is if the patients are seen by a urologist, they'll do an ultrasound, they'll see no flow, and they'll take the testicle out. So you got to warn your patients against the urologist because it's not necessary. Most of these will resolve on their own. At 6 months, the patient has a normal testicle. So these Doppler flow ultrasounds, in my opinion, are not accurate. And I've seen many patients lose their testicle, which I think is needlessly, because I observe all these patients, and they invariably get better. And the thing about it is that the incidence of testicular atrophy does not correlate well with ischemic orchitis. Most patients that develop testicular atrophy did not have orchitis, and conversely, many patients with ischemic orchitis do not develop testicular atrophy. As a matter of fact, the most don't. So let's go on to long-term complications of cord and testicular. Hydrocele. It occurs in 0.5 to 1% of all inguinal hernia repairs. The etiology is probably excessive skeletonization of the cord and disruption of lymphatics. When we leave distal sacs in situ, there's some support that might increase the incidence of hydrocele, but that's very debatable. Treatment is observation initially, and then treated as any other hydrocele if they persist. Testicular atrophy, we've already talked about in relationship to ischemic orchitis, less than 1% overall, but higher with recurrent hernias. The etiology is unproven, but may be arterial. As I mentioned before, most of the type patients have no history of any testicular problems at the time of the index operation. They just have a gradual shrinkage of the testicle over 6 months to a year. Injury to the vas, serious problem. If you recognize it, it should be repaired at the time of surgery with very fine sutures using magnification. It can result in infertility, especially if it's bilateral, obviously, that's going to be a problem. But even if it's a unilateral, because of the extravasation of sperm and the development of sperm antibodies, even in the unilateral injury, it can result in this problem. Now, mesh fibrosis, does that cause obstruction of the vas and infertility? And this is a big problem. This is an article that was published in the Annals of Surgery a few years ago by a lead author by the name of Shen, who is a urologist who specializes in infertility, and he collected cases from infertility clinics across the country and appeared to show that mesh caused obstruction of the vas. So I think we'll take a minute just to examine this. The irony of this is that the Lichtenstein tension-free repair or any of its prosthetic variants should result in a marked decrease in infertility problems. And that is because the recurrence rate being dropped so low means you not be doing so much reoperative surgery, which everybody agrees puts the testicle at greater risk. For example, the testicular atrophy rates for a primary hernia orifice is less than 1%, and where it's around 5% for recurrent hernias. So the tension-free approach should result in improved fertility. So this article was particularly distressing for that reason. Well, let's just look at it. It involved 8 institutions from across the United States, and they collected 14 cases. The obstructive azoospermia was confirmed because the patients had normal sperm in their testicular biopsies, yet no sperm in the ejaculate. All of them had a previous polypropylene mesh hernia orifice. All patients underwent surgical exploration and intraoperative vasography, and the diagnosis was that the mesh was causing the obstruction. Here are the patient characteristics. The average age was 35. Most of the operations were open, but 2 of them were laparoscopic. The operative findings were a dense fibroplastic response encompassing the polypropylene mesh, apparently trapping and destroying and obliterating the vas deferens. 9 patients had bilateral obstructions, and the other 5 had unilateral obstruction but had incidental contralateral pathologies such as congenital testicular atrophy and that kind of thing. Here is a picture from that paper showing the mesh apparently eroding into the vas deferens. So the conclusion by the authors was that before undergoing polypropylene mesh herniorrhaphy, men, especially if in the reproductive age group, need to be carefully advised of the potential for compromise of their fertility. So now, is routine mesh okay in younger patients? This has considerable medical legal ramifications, of course. I questioned the results in the Chin article, and the reason why I did is because I perform a lot of reoperative groin surgery, not for infertility, but for other reasons, such as chronic groin pain. And I see the exact same type of massive, intensive fibroblastic response and scar tissue in the groin that they describe. So I don't think it was unique to these patients. It's just a normal physiological thing that happens when you put a piece of plastic in the groin. And it's supposed to happen, and that's why it's successful. I wrote this editorial for the Annals of Surgery concerning this article, and I postulated that a more likely explanation for this erosion into the vas was a conventional disruption of the vas deferens by division, ligation, clipping, electrocautery, scarification, traction, and then the mesh would adhere to that injured area because it's the most logical thing for the mesh to do to adhere to an injured area, and it would look like it had caused the problem. So I think that I think we've got to be concerned about the possibility of infertility with polypropylene mesh, but I don't think it's an overwhelming problem. Certainly it's not a very high instance of it. Well, let's go on to dysejaculation, particularly distressing complication for patients. It's defined as groin pain or burning just before, during, or immediately after ejaculation. Incidence is approximately 0.4%. It's usually self-limiting, thank goodness. And the etiology is probably some type of damage to the vas deferens. This is another paper concerning ejaculation. Was reported in 33.1% of patients. Pain from the groin or genitals during sexual activity. It was decreased in older patients and decreases with long-term follow-up as it usually kind of gradually resolves on its own. Testicular descent is another distressing complication for patients, commonly not discussed with their surgeons because it's embarrassing, and what the problem here is that the premesteric muscles are compromised. The testicle gradually descends, elongating the scrotum, and eventually the patient's testicles are in the water when they're at the toilet. And they don't like to say that to their doctors, but so people don't know about it many times, but it has to do with not reimplanting the cremasteric muscles if they're divided. Bladder and bowel injury is the next complication. We're almost finished. Bladder and bowel injury, anterior repair. It's very unusual to have a bladder injury, except with large sliding hernias. But the preperitoneal repairs, there's a different story. The bladder is certainly at greater risk, especially if there's been previous surgery in the space of retches, such as a prostatectomy. If you do damage the bladder, the repair should be done in two layers with absorbable suture, followed by extended Foley decompression. Urinary retention. Is a bigger problem with laparoscopic herniorrhaphy than it is with open hernia because of the need for general anesthesia for the laparoscopic operation. So general anesthesia for any inguinal hernia is, of course, very safe in this day and age, but urinary retention is a problem, and so it can be an argument to use open surgery, especially in poor-risk elderly patients. It seems that voiding before operation and restricting fluids to less than 500 cc's during the time of the operation intravenously will decrease the problem. Prosthetic complications. We've kind of talked about the problem of infertility. Infection is a problem, but I'm going to talk about that tomorrow in a lecture on ventral hernias. General complications are those common to all operations, urinary, respiratory, nausea and vomiting, cardiovascular, deep vein thrombosis, many of them considered to be related to the general anesthetic. This is a randomized controlled trial that was done from our shop in the early days of laparoscopic inguinal hernia, and you can see that by far the most common complication was urinary dysfunction, either infection or retention. Respiratory nausea and vomiting problems occurred about the same rate as any other patient undergoing a general anesthetic. Now, the last two are cardiovascular and deep vein thrombophlebitis. Patients need to be prepared properly for surgery, even though it's a minor operation, especially if they're going to have laparoscopic surgery. They have to be prepared properly, and appropriate deep vein thrombosis precautions taken. Laparoscopic complications is the last thing I'll discuss. The problem with laparoscopy is that for inguinal hernia is the laparoscopy, not the hernia, because if the patient is at risk for problems related to the laparoscopy itself and not the herniorrhaphy, such as bleeding, trochar site hernia, subcutaneous emphysema, hypercapnia, diaphragmatic dysfunction, wound infection, and the most serious thing is intra-abdominal injury. Fortunately, these complications are extremely rare, and so laparoscopy is safe for inguinal hernia repair. So with that, I think I'm a little bit over, so with that I'll stop, and I appreciate very much the privilege of the floor.
That was an excellent start for the day. Thank you, Dr. Fitzgibbons.